so I'm going to talk to you about the use of watershed-based tools and resources for competitive. Program in North Carolina, and we've got a lot going on. I feel kind of like Dan mentioned before his last presentation, you know, it's just, there's so much to try to package into 20 minutes. I'm going to try to give you a real flavor of how we're doing business. But in general, the first thing I want to clarify for you is that our program comes into play after avoidance and minimization, and we provide mitigation for all of our Department of Transportation's needs for their impacts, and we also have an in-loop fee program so people can pay us on a unit basis to provide their compensatory mitigation. We've been decoupled, I guess, from the site. You know, I mean, we're told, okay, we need to compensate, you know, 10,000 acres in this area or whatever the number is, and then, you know, we try to cite that on a watershed approach, and I hope you'll get that through this presentation. So. We were asked, as you heard from Dick, to talk about how our restoration priorities are linked to regulatory processes and challenges and opportunities that are posed by that. So what I'm going to focus on is our most detailed form of watershed planning. We actually have a higher level form of planning where we look at our river basins and target 14-digit PUCs within those to put our projects in, and that's kind of a broad-scale effort, but we also have what's called local watershed planning, where we take a subset of those areas and we go and do some very detailed studies to identify restoration priorities. So I'm going to tell you how we choose those watersheds for the detailed studies, what the primary components of local watershed planning are, and how we derive restoration priorities through that process. First of all, the way we get to the watersheds for the detailed plans, every year our DOT gives us their projected impacts based on their TIP over a 7 or 8 year period. So we get, based for all of the 8-digit catalog units in our state, what they foresee happening in terms of impacts to streams and wetlands over time. So they may say, you know, in the year 2005, in the upper Cape Fear River Basin, we're going to impact 10,000 feet of stream and 20 acres of wetlands. So that gives us a guide as to where the impacts are going to be so that we can go do the planning before the impacts occur and be prepared to do the restoration that's needed in that area. So what we do is we kind of cull out the ones that have the greatest magnitude of impacts and look within there at the smaller watersheds and which of those smaller watersheds lend themselves to this detailed planning process. And we apply what we call a screening methodology to those 14-digit PUCs within the 8-digit catalog unit to make that decision. And this is getting at, Dick, what you hit on, which is, you know, where do we want to target our efforts for restoration and watershed planning. You're not necessarily going to, if it's in the National Forest in the Great Smoky Mountains, you know, we're not going to go do a detailed study because it's not going to tell us anything about where to do restoration. And we go through a GIS-based evaluation, and then we get resource professional or RP input into those selections to make sure they agree that we're headed in the right direction. This is just a slide to show you the 8-digit catalog units across the state, and again, those are the areas where we get those projected impact numbers, and then we break those down into the 14-digit watersheds and try to make some decisions of where to focus the planning. What we do through this screening methodology is we look at kind of what we call assets and problems, kind of characterize the range of good stuff within these watersheds and bad stuff within these watersheds. So for the good stuff, we're looking at indicators like resources that we need to be concerned about. Are there endangered species there that need protection? Are there, some high-quality preservation tracts that maybe our natural heritage program's aware of or land trusts are aware of? Are there water supply watersheds that are of concern to people? On the problem side, we're looking at indicators of water quality, habitat, or hydrological problem. or problem. So are we seeing impairment or trends towards impairment? Are we seeing lots of flooding issues that need to be addressed? So we're looking at, again, for indicators of problems. And this is one of our 8-digit catalog units in the western part of the state. And what we did was we took those attributes that I was describing, and I have a whole report on this that maybe I can send to you guys and you can link up as part of this whole thing. But and we take those attributes and we compile them to get one index, or it gives us a range of index, which we can break up, you know, from low to high and kind of get a feel for what the relative assets within all the 14-digit hydrologic units are. So on this map, what you're seeing is the bluer colors are where we have the most things to be concerned about, either water supplies or, you know, important critters that we want to protect. On the flip side, what we're seeing is the same sort of assessment for the problem side of the equation. And so the purple areas are where you see the highest level of issues that might need addressing through a planning effort and restoration projects. Mm-hmm. And the gray lines on here, or white, are the DOT TIP projects that led us to this catalog unit. So those are the ones where we got the numbers that we're going to have all this mitigation that we need to provide for DOT in the future. So that just shows you that we're also throwing into this consideration where those impacts are going to occur on the 8-digit scale. And we have an agreement with the Corps of Engineers that says that our program will compensate for impacts within the same 8-digit catalog unit. So, and then what the resource professionals do is take this information and they kind of look for that mix of where do we have some assets that we want to be concerned about and protect, and, you know, where are we seeing problems that we want to address through planning and restoration. And then we get down into the data some more and find out, well, why is this one popping up to be so high on the problem end of things, et cetera. And then it comes to BPJ. We also seek feedback at the local level to see if there's interest in this, because we want to have good local partnerships. So when we finally make our decision and we get down to do local watershed planning, we do a number of things. And these are very labor-intensive efforts. We do what we call our technical assessment, where we hire consultants to go through and gather and compile and reconcile all of the data that's out there, from the local level to the federal level, everything that we can get, because it varies depending on where you are. Like, some local governments have a lot of really good stuff that you can, you know, put into your data set. Some parts of the state might have better FEMA floodplain data than other places. So we compile everything that's out there. We look for trends. We do models to look at build out, how things are going to change over time. We apply models, and you'll see the results of some of them, hydrologic and water quality models, to see how things might be trending. We also collect watershed water quality monitoring data. We get biological data, storm samples, chemistry samples at base flow to help us find out, you know, what's happening with the watershed, where the problems are, where they're coming from, what's the nature of them. We also do some level of stakeholder involvement, where we involve citizens, local governments, NRCS, Cooperative Extension from NC State University, whoever's appropriate, and it varies depending upon the social condition of the area that you're in, to help us understand the data and make decisions about what restoration priorities should be, how the resource should be applied. And we often contract with either a local environmental group or a university to help us facilitate that process. So we have folks like Jessica who help us, you know, manage the people part of things and keep people on track, and keep us on track too. So what we end up with, and we used to use the pearl analogy, but a friend of mine came up with another one, is developing the shots of the right medicine. Your watershed's your patient, and what you want to do is treat it with the appropriate medicine. You don't want to
you know, give it something it doesn't need or put it where it doesn't need it. And so the dots represent not only the restoration that our program can do with the resources that we have, but it also represents best management practices that could be implemented through grants from other entities. It represents local land use controls that might need to be implemented to protect resources into the future. So the main thing we're trying to achieve here is really a comprehensive watershed restoration effort. And we're only part of the equation. So we want to bring in, we recognize that our projects are going to be better in the context of other efforts, and that those other efforts are going to have more viability and more benefit to the watershed in the context of our efforts. So again, we go beyond in these plans, identifying just what we can use. And we make very specific recommendations based on what the stakeholders and communities say that they want to do in that watershed, as well as what the data is telling us about what's happening in it. And again, I think I just said this, but, you know, for example, if we do a stream restoration project and we can get some funding to do BMPs adjacent to it to regulate the hydrology that caused the instability, that project's going to be a heck of a lot better for the watershed and more viable over time. So we're trying to do this comprehensive implementation. And obviously, partnerships are key to achieving this. This is just to give you a flavor of where we're doing this currently. And we have a number of these online. The dark blue ones are the ones where we've completed the watershed studies, and the yellowish ones are ones we just initiated last year, and the green ones are going to be completed sometime this year. And we'll be adding to this. We are looking at probably starting 8 more this year, but again, we look at those DOT impacts, and we make decisions about where we need to be and start initiating the whole process of deciding where to plan and getting the plan going. And once we get to the detailed part of the studies, that takes about 18 months. So we're looking for increasing the coverage across this map. We prioritize restoration projects based on technical data, stakeholder input, and then you get down to the feasibility. You know, can we actually implement the project? And we apply a variety of different approaches to doing this prioritization. We don't take a one-size-fits-all or prescriptive approach to doing this across the state, and we've been actually sort of experimental so that we can try to figure out if there is one that we want to stick with, but we're not there yet. This is just an example of one of the areas that we've worked in and how we've identified a whole suite of things. This shows wetland preservation, restoration, stream and buffer restoration potential projects, wet pond retrofits, water control structures. And then it also shows how the 14-digit HUC has been broken down into smaller subcomponents or sub-watersheds and prioritized in terms of, based on the data, where, I'm sorry, I keep walking, you know, where they want to start doing the work first to address the issues. We also look at cost-benefit analyses in some of these areas where, across the bottom axis, we have projected cumulative cost of each of the projects, and along the other one is TSS removal. So you can look at the projects, and as you implement them, where you're getting your greatest return on your investment. And at some point, as y'all have seen in economics, that return kind of the slope is not steep anymore. So we say, well, then we'll stop there because we're getting to our goal. Another way of looking at it is, you know, if you've got your suite of projects you're interested in, you can evaluate the load within, and this shows for TSS, total phosphorus and zinc, without the projects, with the projects, and how much of reduction you're getting. So you can actually, using the models, project what sort of improvements you can see in the watershed. If you have a target that you're after, say with a TMDL, and this kind of gets into how we're trying to help meet mutual sort of interests within our department, not just our own, but if we're in a watershed that requires a TMDL, we can use these models to help predict whether we're going to meet that target load that we're after. So, and this shows different management scenarios. It doesn't say what they are, but by applying them, you can get different results. The stakeholder part is very important. We feel that the projects that we come up with, the viability of them is so much greater when we involve stakeholders. And that it sets the stage for implementation. One of the stakeholder efforts that we had in the coastal part of the state was it was sort of a little more labor intensive than we wanted, but we had citizens, et cetera. Once we had recommended projects, we had citizens going door to door, asking landowners to come to a meeting to hear about that restoration project, and we're going to do that project. And it had, like, I think 20 landowners. One of the folks who got really excited about it had a meeting for us, like a little wine and cheese with the other landowners that couldn't make it, to try to get them to buy into this project. And we could tell them why it would be good for their community, for their watershed to do this. And so, we're seeing some good results. And then, there's obviously always going to be feasibility issues. And so when you get down to the site, you've got to look at that. So how do we integrate it into the regulatory context? Well, just reiterating, we come in after avoidance and minimization. We know what the criteria are in terms of how traditional compensatory mitigation is defined now for wetlands and streams. And so if the projects that we come up with comply with that, then we're integrating our priorities into the regulatory context. And what we hope to do is use the results of these studies to demonstrate to the regulators that if we use our dollars to do these BMPs, look how much greater benefit we get than if we apply it to, just if this in-kind thing that you're asking for. So we hope to begin to push the envelope on what's allowable for mitigation. And there are some opportunities to do that. In some parts of North Carolina, you can't provide in-kind mitigation. There's areas where we have to mitigate for wetland impacts, but there are no wetland mitigation opportunities in that. So what do? We do a watershed study, and we do what's right for the watershed. And there are some guidance that has come out in North Carolina just last year that does say how we might begin to do that in urban areas. And this is a very new thing, and we're beginning to package at least one of our plans right now into a format where we're going to make the argument for mitigation for wetlands, actually, even though it says stream guidance. We're going to push that envelope. To get credit for BMPs that will reduce loading. I think things like this are also places where the opportunities are coming out. There are going to be opportunities for integrating holistic watershed restoration into the compensatory mitigation world. There are barriers to it, too. And that button was a button that was worn at the mitigation improvement process that was a convening of agencies, and everybody wore a button that had the little X through, but we've always done it that way because we're trying to change the way things are done. But there is resistance to change, and I think that some of the current policies, like the requirement for no net loss drives things like in-kind, which really can hamstring us. Money is always an issue because you can't do it. You obviously can run out of it. bureaucratic inertia, resistance to change is one thing, but getting agencies, to change, we're talking about it at the national level now, and it's got to change there and trickle down, and then you have your individual regions and their interpretations. And then we also lack methods to measure functional loss and replacement, I think, effectively. I just want to reiterate that the reason we're here is to restore and maintain the chemical and physical and biological integrity of the nation's waters. We get this silo effect. We're sitting here talking about the 404 program. Well, then you've got a whole other program talking about 319, we've got to do restoration. And then you've got, you know, the NPDES thing, and, you know, everybody operates in their own little narrow world, and we forget that if we put all our resources in the same place, in the same watershed, what do you think we could accomplish? So we've got to take us back to the bottom line. And I like to use this quote that my my former boss, Ron Farrell, loved to quote Albert Einstein, and the definition of an insanity is doing the same thing repeatedly and expecting different results. And I'd also like to credit him with getting our program to where we are today and opening these opportunities for us. So.